But I think at the end of the day, when you're saying someone's weight is wrong or someone's body is wrong, and like that's the cause for your intervention, the underlying message still is stigmatizing, regardless of how you say it.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special episode of In Plain English. I'm your host, Jamie Moffa, and today we're going to be talking about the recent American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines that were released at the beginning of 2023. And these are specifically guidelines around treatment of pediatric obesity and children who are overweight. And so here to talk with us about the guidelines and their implications is Dr. Nicole Cifra. Dr. Cifra, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Nicole Cifra, and I am a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist. I'm currently an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine in the Division of Adolescent Medicine. And I have a special interest in eating disorder treatment and prevention, as well as I do some pediatric gynecology as well. But eating disorders has been a longtime passion of mine, and it's a very large part of my clinical practice.
All right. Thank you for that introduction. And our other guest for this episode is Brad Hicks. Brad, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Brad. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a retiree, a 300-pound guy, and a journalism addict, and I'll be playing your designated civilian today.
All right. Well, thank you. And so why don't we get started with Dr. Cifra, what are the new guidelines and sort of like what are the highlights of the recommended practice for physicians treating children who are overweight or obese?
Yeah. So the guidelines are quite comprehensive. So I'll kind of break it down into a few different sections. So basically, the guidelines go through monitoring for comorbidities, as well as interventions for children and adolescents who meet criteria for being overweight or being obese. So a large part of the guidelines deal with specific concepts such as monitoring for different medical conditions that can also occur in someone who is classified as obese. And so specifically, things like testing for prediabetes, testing for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, testing for hypertension or elevated blood pressure. The guidelines kind of break down the screening and monitoring for those comorbidities at different ages based on the evidence that's available. The other part of the guidelines, which I think has caused a lot of conversation, is the management and interventions that are to be offered to families of children that are classified as overweight or obese. And so some of the main things that were discussed in great detail were the intensive lifestyle modifications and counseling, including motivational interviewing around health behaviors that are promoting a healthy lifestyle and perhaps contributing to a decrease in weight or obesity. So that was kind of the main front line or first line intervention. Then there are also some evidence that's presented and guidelines for offering interventions beyond that, such as medications, as well as bariatric surgery in some populations. I think that there's some really good information in the guidelines about different things that go into play with obesity, as well as the discrepancies that they can, kids with obesity can experience and things like that. And so those are discussed in kind of threaded through in talking about the interventions that they suggest be made available.
Is this a departure, I guess, from previous guidelines in terms of like specifically prescribing medications and offering surgeries to children? Is that kind of normal or is that like a little bit surprising?
Yeah, that was a little bit surprising to me. And it's definitely a departure from the guidelines before this set. And I think the biggest thing that has been a difference is the previous guidelines kind of had a little bit more of a watch and wait approach, not really intensively intervening, but rather seeing how children grow and develop as they go through puberty and reach adulthood and things like that. These guidelines, the 2023 ones, were very clear about their departure from those previously held beliefs and advocated for sooner and more intense interventions, including the ones that we mentioned.
Yeah. And so what was the, I assume since these are medical practice guidelines, there must have been clinical research that went into sort of changing these guidelines from the previous ones. So can you talk a little bit about what was the research that led to this change in recommendation?
Yeah, so there are there's quite a few studies that kind of went into this. And I know that there was an intensive literature review with regard to what is available for these interventions, and specifically these interventions in children. And so there is actually a few supplemental documents that kind of go through specifically the comorbidities as well as the interventions for obesity, and talk a little bit about the specific studies that went into those. But there was a robust literature search, and I think that a lot of things that have been discussed among professionals in the eating disorders community, as well as people who are a little bit more surprised at these guidelines, are first kind of the length of increase in health or increase in the intervention, whether that be weight loss or decrease in perceived comorbidities or whatnot, but also being very mindful of the potential harms, which are addressed in many of the studies, but there's debate between whether or not those have been studied as intently as they need to be.
So can you go into some of the potential harms of a sort of more aggressively treating obesity in childhood with medications or surgery?
Yeah, I think that any major change in a developing child, whether that be an intensive lifestyle changes or medication, can have a profound effect. And so I think that those interventions need to be taken really seriously in terms of, you know, making sure that we are not doing any harm. From my perspective, the biggest harm that I see is the over focus on weight specifically as an outcome. I think that there are a lot of good things in these guidelines about promoting time outside, physical activity, a balanced and well-rounded diet, and things like that. But I think that anytime you place an overemphasis on weight as the outcome, it has a potential to be problematic. And specifically, when we're talking about medications or surgeries that can really impact the physiological experience of hunger and satiety and things like that, especially in someone who is developing and growing, I think that there's that should be taken, you know, really seriously. And as someone who takes care of patients with eating disorders for the vast majority of my clinical time, I think it's hard for me to see these guidelines in the setting of having people come into my office with very similar stories about how weight loss was well-intentioned and encouraged by family and peers and medical professionals also. And so that definitely provides a different framework for me and a different lens of which I view these guidelines through.
So I have not actually read the study. I've only read the news coverage of it, which has been a little bit extensive in the science news sections. And they said that the three drugs they were recommending for overweight kids are the same three drugs that my primary care physician is nagging me about, phentermine, metformin, and semaglutide. The two questions I were going to ask about that were, the first question is, have any of these been studied for long-term safety and efficacy in children? And the second question is, given that all three of them are appetite interventions, how many calories a day are people able to eat on these at the normal dosage? And is it enough for a growing child?
Yeah, no, those are good questions. And I think that the long-term implications are something that have come up as a point of concern as well. And the guidelines and the clinical practice guideline was very clear about the potential risks associated with those diseases, particularly with in the settings of family history of endocrine diseases, the potential to increase medullary thyroid cancer and things like that. I think that there wasn't a lot of information that I could find about the specific number of calories. And I think that it's an interesting point And I know that individuals, when they're on these medications, are monitoring energy balance and weight status and kind of tracking progress on the growth curve. But it does give me some pause, given that weight gain or lack of weight gain is only one part of the development of someone through puberty. And I think that given the drastic change in appetite, I wouldn't be surprised if people are consuming significantly less calories than even you know, we would think they would be. To that point as well, a lot of the concerns that have come up are the concerns about weight cycling and the ability to sustain any change in intake for a long period of time. And I think we do have good data about how, you know, these interventions are helpful at meeting the end point of, you know, weight loss while you're taking them.
Short-term weight loss.
Right, while you're taking them. And then the question is, are we putting kids in the situation to be on these medications for life? And, you know, what are the implications for that as well? And is that worth any decrease in comorbidities or other health issues? But I think that those are really important questions that need to be asked.
Well, the reason I asked you about that, doctor, and I brought that up before we started recording, is that I got curious because since it's obvious that appetite suppressant is how these drugs are working in adults as well as in children, it finally occurred to me to ask, how many calories are they letting people eat before the drug makes them feel sick, before the drug intervenes and stops them from eating? And the only data points I were able to find were on Reddit, on a support forum for people who are using one of the semaglutide drugs. And the answers they gave from the people there who were monitoring their calorie intake were a high of 1,100 calories a day and a low of 450. Is that a safe diet for a child?
Yeah, that's not something that I would think any pediatrician would recommend. And I think it's safe to say that I don't know kind of collectively how many calories people are consuming like on average with these drugs, but it's definitely safe to say that many people are likely consuming less than 1,000 or significantly less than 1,000, which I think is pretty extreme and also just not even sustainable. I think that we also, comparing that to weight loss from other mechanisms, just like, you know, typical like dieting or lifestyle changes, that's something that I've come, and I think that the general pediatric community at large has come to appreciate, is when kids come in and have lost weight, asking them how they did that and getting a diet recall for how much that they're consuming, because it's really dangerous to just kind of blindly praise that weight loss. And I think that we need to translate that into when these drugs are being used as well.
I mean, honestly, in a non-scientific context, this is like becoming one of my crusades. I'd like it if we as a society stopped praising people for weight loss, period.
Totally.
At any age.
Totally.
In a clinical setting, in a school setting, in a social setting, just stop talking about people's weight, please.
Absolutely.
To kind of bring this around to Dr. Sifra's specialty and expertise, which is in eating disorders, it's incredibly common for an eating disorder to go unrecognized in an adolescent because their family will praise them, be like, you know, you look so good, you've lost weight, like, especially if they, you know, even if they started out at a quote unquote normal weight, but especially if they started out at, you know, a weight that would put them in the overweight or obese category, that they receive a lot of positive feedback from family and friends, which then only feeds the mentality of like, I'm only good if I can keep doing this. And then if I am not able to sustain this, which I think, as we've been talking about, you know, if these drugs limit appetite as much as, you know, people who are talking about them on forums have documented that they do, like if that's even anywhere close to being the true range of calories that you can eat on these drugs, like that's not a sustainable diet for a child. And then, yeah, you get back into the weight cycling that I think Dr. Sifra was talking about earlier, which not only, and we can get into the science of like how bad weight cycling is for your body and your metabolism, but it also promotes a lot of like, you know, I assume like mental distress of like, oh my God, I like gained back all the weight.
Yeah. And I think that it's also, you know, important from my point of view to recognize that there are a significant amount of people with restrictive eating disorders that start and end their weight loss in the overweight or obese range. And we know that people, there's this discussion in the eating disorder community about the diagnosis of atypical anorexia, which is separated from restrictive anorexia nervosa, in that patients with atypical anorexia, and I'm putting that in quotes, end at a weight that's in the normal range rather than a quote low weight. However, there's been this question about, you know, how atypical is atypical anorexia nervosa? Because really we know that outside of very few exceptions, people that end weight loss in the normal range still have the medical complications of malnutrition that people at low weights do, including, you know, risk of, you know, medical complications, bradycardia, menstrual irregularity, when applicable, and things like that. And so I think also the risk that we run is not identifying those patients sooner because of all of our, you know, biases about obesity, eating disorders, et cetera. That's something that I really, you know, I do worry about, because we know that those patients that start at a higher weight take longer to be detected and to get treatment.
That brushes up against something I wanted to ask that was in the journalism about this these guidelines, is that the guidelines themselves admit in their intro that they are not promising that losing weight will make your kid healthier. Is that in fact missing from the report, or is that in the report?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say kind of globally, but I do know that, you know, we talk about BMI percentiles as, you know, and we can talk about BMI as a measure of health and the relative utility of that as well. But the BMI percentiles are just that. We kind of show it as, we see it as kind of like a rainbow of like some kids are this size, some kids are this size, and there's kind of like a wide range. And I think that there are definitely kids who are tracking in the overweight and obese range of weight and are moving their bodies, engaging in, you know, activity, eating a wide variety of foods. And that is where they're predetermined to be. And just getting that kid from the like overweight or obese BMI to a quote normal BMI make them healthier. For a lot of kids, I don't think it does. And for a lot of kids, I think it definitely, or I know it does, make them less healthy. And so I think that's kind of the risk that you run when you're using weight as the disease in quotes to treat, and using that number as your endpoint. Because I don't think that everyone above the 85th percentile for BMI is unhealthy. I think that bringing them less than that in some cases makes them less healthy.
Well, another thing that I was told was missing from this report is any discussion of why the weight was gained, why the weight is being gained. Because one thing that's come up in the journalism that I've seen, not just about this study, but elsewhere, is that almost no studies are able to tell whether the diseases that are associated with overweight and obesity are caused by the overweight or obesity, or if the diseases themselves cause the overweight or obesity. You know, is your kid getting diabetic because they're fat, or is your kid getting fat because they're diabetic? Is your kid suffering from an inflammatory disease because they're fat, or is the inflammation what's causing the weight gain? Just addressing that through calorie restriction, if it is, isn't going to do anything about the pre-diabetes, isn't going to do anything about the inflammation, isn't going to do anything. Well, in fact, one of the things I was told was that the study explicitly disclaims, we are aware that there are social and economic determinants of health, and we're not going to address any of that in this report.
No, I was reading that. I was kind of shocked that they were like, this is not a report about like the prevention of obesity. It's just a report about treating kids who are already overweight or obese, which...
There's a study I wasn't able to put my hands on, but I have been interested in this question since I saw a 1990 documentary called The Famine Within. And I remember the most important line from that documentary was that the finding as far back as 34 years ago, was that the average woman in America goes on her first diet at the age of 11, starts a new diet on average every 18 months, gained, they said at the time, and I'm told this number has gone up, 8 pounds per weight loss attempt. And that first weight loss attempt was almost always caused or initiated in response to an unkind remark about their weight from an older female relative. I have some concern that we're telling doctors to also tell women at the exact age where eating disorders usually begin that you seem awfully heavy.
I definitely agree with that. And I think that, you know, we know that dieting is the, you know, the biggest predictor of developing an eating disorder. And eating disorders are some of the highest mortality mental illnesses. And so it's not a huge jump to kind of justify that concern, I don't think. Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that I wanted to address too is when they were talking about the intensive kind of counseling and motivational interviewing and stuff like that, they made the distinction about, you know, in these settings where, you know, someone is skilled and is talking sensitively about weight and is not being stigmatized, that hasn't shown to increase the risk of eating disorders.
In a small study with no follow-up and no replication.
But it's also, you know, the guidelines also talk about how those interventions in and of themselves are completely, you know, really inaccessible to a huge part of the population, while saying that kind of that self-guided and, you know, dieting behaviors outside of that setting does increase the risk of eating disorders and disorder eating. And so I think just thinking of this from a practical standpoint, given that those interventions aren't available to, I think, the vast majority of kids in America, a lot of them are going to be getting this counseling from people who, you know, don't have that perspective or training and looking at things by themselves because they're under the perception that their weight is wrong. I think that regardless of the evidence behind the, you know, safety of those intensive treatments and counseling in and of themselves, just practically, I think that there's, what are kids going to do or what are families going to do when those things aren't accessible? They're going to try to replicate it the best they can. And that comes with risks as well.
To a first approximation, I read that level of whole lifestyle intervention is available to maybe 300 kids a year with the current number of clinicians who are trained to provide it. So to a first approximation, that's zero. Similarly, and what's more, it's going to cost thousands of dollars, which is going to really sharply limit its availability to the people most likely to need it because it's not covered by any known insurance or by Medicare or by Medicaid. Neither are most of the drugs that they are recommended covered by Medicare, Medicaid. And semaglutide is, at its lowest estimate, about $800 a month with no insurance or discount coupons at all, closer to $2,000. So to a first approximation, no one's going to be able to afford that for their kids either. So what we're talking about is telling the kid to be aware of their weight, because an overweight kid certainly isn't getting that at school, and then leaving them on their own, or, you know, at most giving them metformin and hoping that that doesn't have long-term consequences and that that doesn't produce rebound weight gain.
Yeah, right. And I think in the media that the AAP did about these guidelines, they try to be, you know, very clear, which I think was good, that the medications and the bariatric surgery was not first line.
But the thing they recommended for first line just isn't available.
So what do you do when they're like, the first line isn't feasible? Like, you know, you move on to other treatments. And so that's kind of how I see this playing out. And I think that the potential for harm is so great, which is, you know, why I've been concerned about this.
And one of the other things according to the press reports, the report itself explicitly disclaims is that it's not going to address rebound weight gain. Aren't all of these at high risk of rebound weight gain in excess of the initial weight loss? Because as a 300-pound guy, I gained almost all of my weight after a long period of calorie restriction, have tried to lose weight 3 times since then, and every single time gained 12 to 25 pounds at the 3-year mark. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the report does explicitly says we're not going to address rebound weight gain. Isn't that kind of a glaring omission?
Yeah, and I think it's hard to address like rebound weight gain when weight gain is expected in like the childhood years.
Okay, fair. If the child goes up a foot in height, presumably they're going to gain weight, period.
Right, right. But I do think that it's a good point. And it's something that, you know, was mentioned briefly in the guidelines, But I think the question for me is, are people going to be, you know, ending up at higher percentiles than they would have been had they not gone through this dieting cycle? And I think, you know, from what we know of adults, I think that's a fair question. But I think that, you know, in the guidelines talked about the limited data kind of longitudinally that's available as well. But I think that those are all good questions, as are if you're concerned about comorbidities, does dieting now with weight loss that may or probably may not be sustained impact development of those comorbidities at a decreased rate in the future?
I was going to ask if there are any studies on that. I think it's an important thing to address.
They did mention a little bit about how when weight is regained, a lot of the decreased factors for developing like things like prediabetes or hyperlipidemia or things like that go away with that increase in gain or like rebound weight gain. So I think that it's fair to say that, you know, those benefits don't seem to be sustained.
They only last as long as the intervention.
Right. And, you know, how feasible is takeout medications? How feasible is having this intensive, you know, lifestyle modification and counseling of, you know, an excess of 26 hours over a 3 to 12 month period? Like, how sustainable is that? So it's a question that I could tell people were thinking of, but I think is, you know, a really compelling concept when weighing the risks and benefits, and that, you know, the benefits may not be.
We know what benefit the parents want. The benefit the parents are most concerned about is not whether their kid's going to get diabetes or whether their kid's going to get arthritis or whether their kid's going to get liver disease. The concern the parents are concerned about is whether or not my kid is going to get bullied, whether or not my kid is going to be thought of as ugly. And is that one going to last if there's rebound weight gain? Obviously not.
And I'm glad that that was addressed in terms of the fact that weight stigma exists in the healthcare system and weight stigma exists in schools and among families and communities and things like that. But I think what missed the mark for me is that was used as a, maybe justification is the wrong word, but that was used as kind of evidence for why intervention is needed. Whereas I see that as let's change the culture that makes it acceptable to bully people or disparage people or, you know, have weight stigma.
Or to refuse to hire them.
Right, exactly. And so that's a societal problem. And I think that that's really, you know, what needs to be addressed. And having kids shrink their bodies into something smaller that is, you know, more acceptable to society, I think is not the right answer in that case. And I think that it's hard for me to not see it as that.
Yeah, I actually have some concern, talk about social determinants of health, that since the COVID lockdowns and remote schooling, now that kids are back in school, they have not, as far as I can tell from talking to teachers and to kids, brought back the bystander intervention education program that was doing such effective anti-bullying work before COVID.
I can't speak to that specific intervention in schools, but I think that we know that weight-based bullying is one of the most common forms of bullying. I think that in some ways, I think people consciously or subconsciously see that as okay or more acceptable than other forms of bullying. I think because of this notion that weight is closely, you know, related to specific health behaviors or kind of morality or things like that.
People have this perception that someone's weight is entirely under their control. And so if they're overweight, it must be because of something they did. So, you know, this breaks down in two places, which is like, I've heard statistics from the wonderful podcast Maintenance Phase that, you know, 95% of people who, you know, try to lose weight end up regaining all of the weight. And that's in adults. But, you know, I can't imagine that it would be that much different in children. But also that, you know, even to the extent that your weight is under your control, it's not that effective to shame somebody into like losing weight. That's not mentally healthy or an effective intervention.
And I believe that that was mentioned. But I think that for me, I think I like that that was mentioned in these clinical practice guidelines. And I like all this stuff about person first language, not using stigma, checking kind of your own weight stigma as a pediatric provider. But I think at the end of the day, when you're saying that someone's weight is wrong or someone's body is wrong, and like that's the cause for your intervention, there's limited ways in which people can perceive that. And I think that the underlying message still is stigmatizing, regardless of how you say it.
If we've just established is that there really isn't anything safe, effective, and available, what should pediatricians be telling their parents, their patients, and their patients' parents?
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of the principles that my colleagues and I talk about often is, you know, pretty consistent with a lot of what is in the 07 guidelines, which is really focused on behaviors, focus on getting exercise or physical activity, and not linking that to you're burning calories for the aim of losing weight. Like being outside in nature has health benefits. Exercising and getting your heart rate up has health benefits. And those things are still true, even if someone doesn't lose weight. And I think sometimes, you know, a little bit of what I worry about is if we keep framing this as losing weight as the outcome, then people over years are going to not do those things that are, you know, good for their bodies because they, you know, perceive failure or that they, you know, haven't gotten out of it what they were expected to or need to. And so I think all of those health behaviors are really, you know, worth promoting. I just think that the use of obesity as a proxy is just what I have a really hard time getting behind.
Sure. But Dr. Sifra, imagine yourself in clinical practice. You have a patient sitting in the room with you and their parent standing over them. And the parent says, "Help, doctor, my kid is getting fat. What can I do?" What are you going to tell them?
I would emphasize their trial, like in the individual sense, related to their growth and trajectory. So if there's been a deviation of multiple BMI percentile lines in the upward range, I think that definitely makes me, you know, think about like what may be going on here that can be causing that, similarly to when someone drops 3 BMI percentile range. If someone has been consistently growing along the 85th or 95th percentile and is doing all the things that we talked about that are healthy, I think I don't see an issue with that child in terms of their growth and development. And I think, you know, I'm pretty clear about that with patients and with parents that weight is but one vital sign, and, you know, intervening on that alone is problematic. And sometimes, you know, being upfront about the relative, how long the interventions last. So like talking about dieting and saying, no, dieting or having really extreme behaviors may cause, you know, with the aim of weight gain may cause weight loss in the short term, but likely won't be sustained. And if your child is growing and developing well and is doing all these things, then like I consider that healthy. And so that's kind of the counseling that I use. But I think it's hard for parents as well because they're taught in other medical settings or through media consumption.
Or from their peers.
Yeah, that certain weights cannot be healthy. But I don't agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is an area where a lot of, you know, medicine falls short. Just sort of speaking from my own experience, I am in training to become a physician as well as a researcher. I'm in training forever. In my clinical experience so far, the most prevalent like examples of overt bias from physicians that I can think of are surrounding weight. You know, I've witnessed very little overt bias with respect to queer people, with respect to people of color, which obviously that exists. But like the most glaring examples I can think of are doctors just thinking it's completely okay to shame their patients for being fat and to refuse care for patients who are overweight. And I think that that's something that I'd also like you to speak to is, do you see this sort of similar thing in the pediatric setting where pediatricians will dismiss or like not engage with other health concerns that the child is having or that the parents are having about the child in favor of just recommending that they lose weight before addressing other concerns that they're bringing?
And before you answer that question, I'd like to add one more clause onto that question, which is, and aren't these 2023 guidelines going to make that worse?
Yeah, I definitely see that. And I think that it's important to also like recognize, we know that even professionals that treat eating disorders have weight bias. I am not immune to that. And so I don't say this in, you know, any sort of kind of moral high ground. I think it's really entwined into the fabric of our society. I certainly have seen that. I think that bias can cut both ways as well. I always think of the example of PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome. And we're taught that PCOS is, you know, has an association with people with higher weight, which is, while true, I think is overemphasized, and that causes a lot of misdiagnoses in multiple ways. So I think that sometimes I see it as, people come in who are in larger bodies and have menstrual irregularity and was kind of blamed on their weight. And then they're not tested for hormone levels that would make the diagnosis of polycystic ovarian syndrome. And, you know, there's a delay in that diagnosis because people are kind of in the tunnel vision of, oh, you know, your weight is really the problem. On the flip side, though, I get people coming in with BMIs in the normal range who have menstrual irregularity. And sometimes people will be like, oh, well, you can't have PCOS, like you're not obese, which is not the case. And so those people have, you know, those patients have a delay in diagnosis because we have that bias in our head that only people of certain body sizes can suffer from certain diseases. And I think that in those, like, I think that that really represents the fact and kind of draws it out pretty clearly that weight bias really helps no one.
As someone who works in this field and someone who read this report, what is obviously glaringly missing in the research? What research would you like to see more support for?
A lot of like the beginning part of the guidelines, such as the talks about the environmental factors and social determinants and, you know, weight bias, stigma, stuff like that, I think is, was really good. And I think I would love to see how impacting those factors would impact some of the outcomes, weight related or not. Does living in like a more walkable community or living in a place that, or like sending your kid to school where there's like breakfast and lunch that are, you know, well balanced and nutrient dense, do those things impact health outcomes? And I think we do have good evidence that those things are beneficial, but I wonder if that research can be more robust. And I think that would emphasize that those factors are really the point to which we should intervene rather than individuals' weight status.
That reminds me of a question I wanted to ask, which is that one of the things that's come up in the journalism that I go through, the stuff for laymen, is that there are a few things that are pretty reliable, not so much at healing weight gain after it's happened, but at preventing it. And that is to make sure that your kids are getting at least 7.5 hours of restful sleep a night, and to make sure that your kids either avoid chronic stress or are taught better how to manage chronic stress, because chronic stress is obesogenic. Is that backed up by the research, you know?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that we know that having improved sleep or an adequate amount of sleep is helpful in regards to like a healthy energy balance, as well as mental health, all these other things. And so definitely, I love that was mentioned here, because those are huge things for kids that are issues with early school start times and things like that. Like, those are real barriers that, again, have more societal or systemic solutions.
Right. I was going to ask, because you're in addition to having an MD, you also have a master's in public health. So I was going to ask, on sort of the public health or population level, like, what would be some of your recommendations or some things that you would hope to see discussed that would promote healthy children, you know, on a population level, and things that might be accessible or be able to be implemented in the kinds of like lower income communities that, you know, as the report itself mentions, like, you know, overweight and obesity is more prevalent in?
So I'm going to, and I think I mentioned this before, I'm going to credit my colleague, Dr. Katie Miller, because she had a really, she's done a few interviews about these guidelines and has put some really good information out into the interwebs about different ways to approach this. So a lot of what I'm going to say, I think is probably what she said. So I want to credit her for that as well. But I think those are kind of systemic things like having food subsidies, such as like, you know, subsidizing fruits and vegetables and making them affordable and available in all communities, including breakfast and lunch at school, having cities and parks and environments that are walkable, that are safe for people to engage in exercise of mild, moderate, or higher intensity, and, you know, be safe and be available for them to do that. And another thing is, as a culture, decreasing that stigma, because we know that it's not helpful, and it's not helpful with the aim of weight loss either. And so I think what we were talking about and what you were referencing in the medical setting, teaching kids and as a society moving toward a more weight inclusive society and culture, and not commenting on people's bodies, whether they gained weight or lost weight or whatever. Because I think there's a number of things that people can be dealing with that can impact their weight that aren't necessarily good, bad, or whatever. The fact that we sometimes tolerate these comments about other people's bodies, I think, is a real point of intervention.
So what you're saying is we need to build a pickleball court within 300 yards of everybody's front door.
Or, you know, just sidewalks.
Yeah. Sidewalks, trails.
Street trees.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we know that those things can benefit people in a lot of different ways. And I know that there's been a lot of discussion as well about grocery stores or the capacity of them in different communities and addressing that to make sure all of these different foods that we're suggesting be incorporated into people's intake are in fact available and are feasible for them to get.
Right. Because it's, you know, it's one thing to tell the family of a child, like, your kid needs to eat more vegetables, but it's another thing for that family to actually be able to afford the vegetables and get to a place where there are the vegetables and buy them.
Well, as someone who's trying for health reasons to eat a more balanced diet anyway, for God's sakes, our food culture does a terrible job of providing shelf-stable edible vegetables, shelf-stable edible fruit. That's basically canned goods with too much salt or too much sugar. And what the canned vegetables are boiled to the point, as part of the canning process, to the point where there's no nutrients or flavor left in them. The canned fruits are packed in sugar to keep them from spoiling. Fresh food doesn't even keep.
And I think a lot of that comes down to also the policy of what is subsidized and things like that and what we're investing in. And we know that, you know, putting my public health hat on, a lot of the biggest successes in health and public health have come from changes that are not individual changes. They're community, political, policy changes. And I think that that's a really, you know, and one of the things that I think is mentioned but not adequately addressed, in my opinion, is the role of those factors in promoting health and wellness. It's mentioned, but I think at the end of the day, all of the interventions that they discussed were really individual interventions, intensive counseling, medications, things like that.
That's our social bias. We're Americans. We don't want to know, what do I have to do to make everybody else healthier? We want to know what I can do to make myself and my family healthier, because that's the only part I'm responsible for.
And we want to think that we have control of that.
If a parent and their kid are standing in your clinical room and you tell them there is nothing you can do individually to make your kid skinnier, that's powerlessness to them. They're not going to welcome that.
Right. I mean, which is why these conversations are so difficult to have and why there's so few clinicians who are equipped to have them. I mean, especially considering that like pediatricians working in primary care need to see so many kids. Yeah, being able to address that and saying, you know, actually, first of all, your kid's weight isn't the best indicator of their overall health status. But second of all, like having a conversation about, you know, even on the individual family level, being able to get them connected with social resources is a lot harder than saying like, well, your kid just needs to go on a diet.
And it was interesting that with the intensive health and lifestyle measures that were discussed, how that was brought up, that pediatricians really, you know, for the volume and frequency, and they talked about kind of the dose relationship between amount of time and the degree of improvement that they saw based on what they were measuring. Pediatricians, it's really may not in most situations have bandwidth. And so they offered some other ways, including resources in the community with, you know, registered dietitian or exercise scientists and things like that. But I think too, when interventions are so intense, that I think that it's really hard for me to be reassured that all of those individuals are going to be, you know, if it were my kid, that they're going to be sensitive and not stigmatizing and stuff like that, especially when you're asking them to really intervene with the frequency that they're charged with. I think that that can be a little tricky. And I think it's also can be so much more variable.
We have got to do something about the for-profit weight loss industry, because that's the other place where this is all coming from. It is not a coincidence that there are two, about to be three, brand new patented weight loss drugs, and all of a sudden doctors are being pressured to prescribe them. And these are drugs that are going to give your kid an eating disorder. Okay, I know you're going to make me caveat that some. And they are drugs that are going to cause your kid to go through a lifetime of rebound weight gain. And it's going to, but in the short term, the financial pages of the newspaper are bursting with stories about how much money these companies are going to make off of these $2,000 a month injections.
You know, I disagree that when, you know, saying that these medications aren't going to cause an eating disorder. I mean, for most people, probably not. But one of the things that I always talk about are that eating disorders are so insidious, and they can come about in really the most sneaky ways. And we talk about, you know, things that can trigger an eating disorder are, you know, dieting is a big one. But sometimes it's as simple as people have a viral illness or get their wisdom teeth taken out and lose weight. And that in people that are predisposed to developing these illnesses, those thoughts and that energy imbalance in the feedback that they get from society really triggers that weight loss cycle that is so hard to get out of. And so, I mean, I think I definitely worry with these medications that have a big decrease in appetite. And that's like really the desired effect. For some people, I think that they will cause them to get eating disorders, just like people that are on stimulants for ADHD. They modify appetite, and most kids don't develop an eating disorder, but some do. And when they do, it's really not scary. And those are the diseases that are going to kill them.
Certainly a lot faster than any of the like metabolic conditions that might be associated with their weight.
Right, exactly. That sort of thing is what makes me so scared, really, about the effect that these guidelines could have. Yeah, I just think that the opportunity for harm it really concerns me. And I think, too, that, one of the things that I'm thinking of down the road is when we're talking about increasing, you know, these behaviors and looking more intensely at weight as a health measure, you know, there are not a lot of eating disorder professionals out there. Like, there are not enough of us. I think that a lot of kids will, you know, not develop eating disorders even with intensive interventions. I think that there's such variability, and we can't predict it. And who's going to be there to help these kids when, you know, they need hospitalization for their malnutrition? That scares me as well. Because I just know that, especially, you know, depending on where you live, that care isn't as available. And the need to get care quickly is important for prognosis from an eating disorder.
I was going to say, I don't remember the exact studies or statistics, but yeah, that like early diagnosis and treatment is the best predictor of like full recovery.
Yeah. And like, who has a longer lapse between onset of symptoms and diagnosis is people who start or end or whatever at higher weight. Yeah, there's no getting around that.
Oh, that reminds me of something that I meant to ask, which is one of the things I've seen in the journalism about these recommendations is that the three recommendations that they said were potentially effective, the intense full whole lifestyle counseling over 6 months, or the three approved weight loss drugs for kids as young as 8, for God's sake, and or bariatric surgery for kids as young as 12, for God's sake, is that they are not actually talking about offering you making your kid thin. They are talking about making your fat kid maybe 5 to 10% less fat. It's not going to save them from weight stigma. It's not going to save them from the health consequences of still being overweight. It's going to cost you thousands of dollars. It's got potentially long-term down the road costs. But I think parents have a really inflated idea of just how much weight loss these interventions are going to produce, even if rebound weight gain weren't a thing. I think people have a really inflated idea of just how much weight their kid's going to lose.
Do you know off the top of your head, what are the like average weight loss numbers for, you know, let's take the like semaglutide drug in children?
Yeah, I don't know that off the top of my head, but I know that there's the data suggests that it only works as long as you take it, really. Like there's so much, and like this is something that I've been thinking about recently with the course of eating disorder treatment, how, you know, we know that early and intensive and high quality treatment improves prognosis. And like, those are the things that we can intervene upon. But there's an element of seeming randomness to people's course that isn't always explainable. And I think that likewise, there's no way to tell who's going to be at risk of an eating disorder until they develop one. And so, you know, I wish that there was a way to say like, okay, kids that are, you know, at high risk for developing an eating disorder, like we know who they are and they're not going to get these interventions to like minimize the harm done. But there's no great way to do that. And even other ways such as family history and things like that aren't really mentioned as precluding these interventions.
That's really surprising. At least as far as I know, the only thing that I can think of that I know has data behind it is, yeah, that like a family history of eating disorders predicts eating disorders. That's incredibly surprising that that wouldn't be listed as a contraindication.
Is it specifically family history, or is it general social contagion? Because I was under the impression an awful lot of eating disorder contagion was from peer-to-peer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be, but there are definitely genetic predispositions. And from twin studies and things like that, we know that there are definitely genetic implications. But I think I know a lot of it is also what you described. And I think that's kind of like the classic nature versus nurture. And in the case of eating disorders, I think, you know, both are at play. But I couldn't find that directly addressed as a way to screen for people who may have a risk of, you know, that complication. I know that they, somewhere in one of these documents, it was mentioned in people with a history of eating disorders that to, you know, proceed with caution, which, yes, please. But also, I think that we can be a little bit more liberal on how we apply that caution.
Right, because a whole lot of people, I would bet, have sort of disordered eating, which I'm not entirely sure if there's a clinical definition of disordered eating, but the way I think of it is just sort of like unhealthy patterns around food that don't really rise to the psychological level of like an eating disorder, which is really sort of an obsession with like controlling your food intake.
I kind of define it as like the delineation between disordered eating and an eating disorder. The way I conceptualize it is like the concept with substance use, which is one of the criterion, is repeated use despite harm. So like someone who has disordered eating or is having like worrisome dieting behaviors, you know, they're able to readjust if like they can't re-engage in their sport or they lose their period and they're like, oh gosh, that's bad, like let me fix this, and they're able to make those adjustments. But I think like with an eating disorder, that's a, you know, diagnosed with a DSM-5, really having that like pull to those behaviors, despite, you know, not doing well in school, having medical complications, ended up in the hospital or whatever they may be, and continuing down that road that kind of separates an eating disorder from eating. But I feel like a lot of disordered eating is so normalized, which is why, again, potential harms are so concerning, because tons of kids, young kids, have worrisome dieting behaviors.
Now, I brought this up with the friend who introduced me to Jamie, and he said something interesting, which is, Brad, the AAP report isn't going to do that much harm because most of the people who are at most risk can't even afford to see a pediatrician, so they're never going to hear about it. And on top of that, the kids who, you know, who could conceivably be harmed by semaglutide aren't going to be able to afford the $2,000 a month anyway, so these guidelines are just going to be ignored.
I think that, you know, even though there's may not be the infrastructure to enact these guidelines in the way that they were intended, I think even the concept of there is potentially a fix to what we're saying is a problem, I think that concept just being out there is problematic in and of itself. Even if people aren't taking these drugs, kind of like knowing like, oh, my body is incorrect and needs to be fixed in this way, even though I may not have access to it or like whatever, you know, it needs to be fixed. That's pretty harmful in and of itself. But I definitely agree with, you know, the limitation societally to kind of follow through on all of those recs.
Well, this is one reason why the social determinants of health angle and the public health angles are so important, is there's never going to be enough specialists. There's never going to be enough doctors to treat. Even if we had an effective weight loss intervention that didn't have any drawbacks, that didn't have any side effects, the perfect, you know, handed down by God, no, really, this one will work. If it required manual intervention by specialists for every patient who needed it, we got more patients that need it than we're ever going to be able to fund.
I think this also brings up a question that I had, which is, what is kind of the on the ground opinion of medical providers that you work with or that you interact with, maybe that are not in the eating disorder field? Do people generally think these guidelines, like accept these guidelines? Is there a lot of pushback against them, like professionally speaking?
It's hard for me to tell because and this is my own bias of experience. Like I have privilege to practice in a group of people who are like highly passionate about the same things that I do. And my interaction is pretty specific. And, you know, the mentorship and community that I have within the medical profession is a lot within the eating disorder community. I think, you know, socially just hearing from friends who are in primary care or are in other specialties, I've heard kind of a mixed review. Some people I think are thankful to have some sort of structure or guidelines about what they can offer and some framework for what to offer patients. I think some people also are hesitant about having these discussions and have appropriate hesitation about the possibility of harm. And I think also one thing I've heard is, okay, like how would we even make this happen? I think that just varies from geographic region to clinical setting and the resources that are available. So that's kind of, you know, and again, my sample size isn't huge. These are mostly like people that I know from residency and in my training that are practicing in primary care. But that's kind of like the mix of responses that I've gotten from people outside of the eating disorder community.
In the interest of fairness, the committee or the authors, or however it's you want to phrase it, of this report have to have seen the criticism that's been in the eating disorder community, that's been in the health reporting community. How have they responded to that criticism?
I don't know. There hasn't been anything public that I'm aware of from, I think, the creators of the guidelines about that, at least formally. But I do think that while there are some things that are really problematic in these guidelines, there are some things that I think are worth discussing. And I think that the people that I professionally work with in the eating disorder community I know that there have been some discussions about how to best collaborate and make sure that our patients are kind of represented and taken into consideration in the creation of this sort of thing. But I don't know formally if there hasn't been any specific response to those criticisms that have come out. I think there probably will be. I think too, one thing that I do know that has been addressed and they've responded to is the concept that a lot of these interventions aren't, and especially the intensive health and behavioral lifestyle changes, the inaccessibility to a wide variety of the population. I know that they've responded to that and have kind of clarified that, you know, that was something that they had struggled with in putting that information in the guidelines, because they know it's not accessible to probably the majority of kids. But they felt like their goal was to present the evidence that's available, regardless of feasibility. And so I know that they've been responded to that criticism or those comments about the guidelines. I just don't know if the specific eating disorder related concerns have been discussed openly. I know the Academy for Eating Disorders, as well as some other professional committees, have put out statements expressing their concerns, but they haven't responded to those yet.
To put this in context, the American Academy of Pediatrics is sort of the largest. It's sort of like it's providing guidelines for all like U.S. pediatricians on this, on a number of different issues. It's a like very large medical body. It kind of makes sense to me, knowing what I know about large medical bodies, that they would act slowly and have a lot of internal conversation before they say something that is going to be perceived as representing the opinion of pediatricians.
Mm-hmm. And I think even like the number of people involved in creating these guidelines is like pretty big. So
I was going to ask, what is the likelihood that any part of these guidelines gets revised? Like, obviously they revise them on a years long time scale.
I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. One thing that I did look up is, we were talking about the GLP-1 agonists and their effectiveness in weight loss. And so I did pull up one of the studies that they had cited and the effectiveness for weight loss. And what I found was that they had found a 1.3 kilogram per meter squared decrease in BMI over 20 weeks for pediatric patients for which the medication was given for weight loss.
That would be, well, that's a drop in BMI of 1, right? Is 1%?
Yeah, 1.3. So I'm thinking, so if someone had a BMI of 30,
it would be a 28.5.
Right. So that's like a 4% decrease at most.
And if they only measured it at the 20-week mark, that doesn't tell you whether it's continuing to accelerate or not, let alone address rebound weight gain. But so is it that, you know, that drop from 30 of BMI to a 28.5 BMI, and then another down to 27, and then another? Or is that just going to be where it plateaus? They haven't even tried to measure that yet?
I think that was kind of the end point of what they were looking for.
So, okay, what I had read was correct, was that this is not, in fact, going to take your fat kid and turn them into a skinny kid. It's going to take your fat kid and turn them into a slightly less fat kid for $2,000 a month for the rest of their life.
You know, if there are... parents of kids out there who like, or medical professionals, pediatricians, like, who kind of want to push back on this and offer a different framework. Like, I know it can often be very difficult for parents or just patients going in to see a doctor to sort of say like, hey, I'm not, you know, comfortable with this, or I'm not sure that this is the right thing for me. Like, how would you recommend parents kind of like support and like stand up for their kids and like, you know, maybe push back against these kinds of like weight stigmatizing conversations?
Well, I think that, you know, with every medication or any intervention, including talking about weight status, it's kind of an informed consent process, and parents can decline treatment. And I think that if someone is offering a kid a medication or intervention based on their weight, you know, they're not offering them metformin for glycemic control or anything like that, a parent is well within their right and should feel empowered to say, you know, I hear the relative risks and benefits, and this is not something that I'm interested in for my child at this time or period. And I think that, you know, parents should be empowered. And I wish that there was a way to address the power differential in a more consistent and sustainable way. But I think that it's reasonable for families to say, you know, no, that's not something that we're interested in.
I think, you know, obviously there's a lot more that needs to be addressed with that kind of power differential. But even hearing a doctor say, like, no, you are, as a parent, within your right to say something about this, is like, I'm hoping that possibly there's even one person, and maybe it's not even about their child, maybe it's about themselves, that they feel empowered to say, like, hey, I don't think this is right for me, because doctors have a lot of knowledge, but are also still people and also still have biases. And at the end of the day, you know, it's your body and or your child's body that they're you're talking about. And
yeah, I guess as an elderly activist, but admittedly a child-free one, I guess what I would tell parents is, you have been told since you first picked them up that you're responsible for their safety, not the doctor, not the nurse. You are the one who's going to blame yourself if your kid gets hurt. If the doctor is giving you what sounds to you like unsafe medical advice, you got to stand up for them just like you would stand up to any other bully who's bullying your kid. At least I hope like you would stand up for your kid against a bully. And I know I'm asking a lot. I know standing up to a bully, particularly one who is richer than you, more powerful than you, with a lot more years of education, standing up to a bully is hard, but it's your kid. You've got to protect them.
I think that I don't know many. I'm not going to say I don't know any, but I think that physicians and pediatricians in general, if parents are hesitant or wanting to get more information or a second opinion, I know it's harder to think about like second opinions in the primary care setting. I think that most physicians would not feel like opposed or threatened. I want to have, like, when people come to me and are looking for someone else to advise them or to get thoughts from another provider, that's something that I'm always open to. Like, I feel like my job is to make sure that patients and families have all the information. And I talk about this when I do counseling about like birth control and things like that. Like, my job is for you to know what I know and to answer your questions so you can make the decision that's best for you. And if that involves talking with, for example, like a gynecologist or someone else, then I want you to have that information. I think that a lot of pediatricians would support families that are looking to get more information before starting a medication or anything like that. But again, it's like bringing it up that there's a medication that can, like, quote, fix this issue. Yeah, like, is that problematic in and of itself? Which I think that, you know, in many cases it is.
I'm betting that there's probably medical students and residents who listen to this, since that is the demographic I'm a part of and the people who I talk to on a daily basis. So, like, what would you say to people who are going through medical education right now, and they, you know, it's not really questioned within medical education that, like, weight is an important topic to talk to your patients about. So I guess, like, what advice would you give to medical students and residents who are concerned about this?
I would say, as someone who has gone through training, like, pretty recently, I always talked with medical students and residents about, and fellows too, about that, you know, there's this hierarchy in medicine. And I think as people in training, we're conditioned to not understand how much influence we can still have and how our role is so important in empowering families and giving information and things like that. We know that having medical trainees and medical students on healthcare teams improves outcomes in terms of, like, you know, the Swiss cheese model that is healthcare. And I think that even if you're kind of uncomfortable with discussions or kind of the ways that things are discussed by other members of the team, your voice in talking with patients and how you counsel patients and families can still have a profound impact. And that can go in both directions, but I think in people that for people in training that are concerned about the ways that weight are discussed in healthcare, they can have a huge influence on that for the positive. And so they shouldn't discount their own influence in those situations. And I really want to empower them to, develop their own styles and their own ways of counseling people about these issues.
You know, for me, that's really important to hear. And I hope that's something that listeners who are in those positions take away as well. So, Dr. Sifra, you mentioned that you write for a few blogs. Do you want to let listeners know where they can find your writing?
Oh, yeah. So I'm on Twitter a lot. And so I say, like, that's my main social media platform. And so I do like some different like for Eating Disorders Awareness Week. I did a bunch of tutorials about different aspects of eating disorder care and counseling and medical complications and things like that. So you can follow me at Dr. Nicole C. on Twitter, not on any other platforms. I'm on like Spoutable and Mastodon and things like that, but not any, I'm not on Instagram or anything like that. I can only focus on one thing. So I do that. And then I've written for the Klossler blog out of Johns Hopkins University a few times about just various aspects of medical care and being in training and you know, just different kind of humanism and medicine.
All right. Thank you. And Brad, do you have anything to promote?
I backed off of Twitter even before Elon bought it. I've backed off of Facebook lately because their advertising got too dense even for my ad blocker to weed through. These days, the only places you can find me on social media are, of all places, on Tumblr and Reddit, both cases as Infamous Brad, InFamousBrad.
Thank you both for this really amazing conversation. And once again, we've been talking with Dr. Nicole Sifra and Brad Hicks about the recent American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines about pediatric obesity. Thank you again so much for tuning in. And thank you to both of you for being on the podcast.
You're welcome. And good luck to everyone out there.
Thank you.
Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at plainenglishsci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.